This is work in progress with Kim Okainalainen and Mike Trott, and I think we're very close to being able to make more definitive statements than I can tell you today, if only I hadn't had to prepare this talk. So the background you've already heard from Mike today, I can just remind you briefly. We're motivated by these results from D0, which are either evidence or an indication of new CP violation in bee decays. And did I hear somebody say that this bee decay actually doesn't harmonize with the other?
The one experiment, the deviation is only now one sigma away, where the D0 didn't really move. So it's neither confirming or denying at this point, but it's not a screaming deviation compared to the dynamo.
Right, but much larger uncertainties than other CP violation measurements. Therefore, it's subject to much more interesting fluctuations, and those are coming down, so we measure them better.
In any case, this is the inspiration for, we want to try to do electroweak baryogenesis with this model. That's the basic idea of this talk. And the model, once again, is just a two Higgs doublet model, except unlike two Higgs doublet models that have been considered in the past, this one has minimal flavor violation as the principle for how you couple the Higgs to quarks. And so that's something that hasn't been looked at very much yet. And this is just a reminder of the kind of couplings you get to the new Higgs. There's the Yukawa coupling structure in here, which translates into CKM matrix elements, so that these new physics contributions have the same structure as you get from the standard model box diagram. And so that's why they give small flavor changing neutral currents. And as Mike told us, these new couplings are CP violating, and so that's why this gives a contribution to the CP violation in the B meson mixing. So here is this model again. This is the most general two Higgs doublet model you can write down. Nothing is forbidden by extra imposed symmetries. And in addition to the CP phases I showed you before, which are in the couplings to the quarks, the scalar sector by itself has these CP violating, they can be complex couplings. And it turns out that only two of those are really new phases. You can remove two of them by field redefinitions. Now, if you're used to thinking about two Higgs doublet models like the MSSM or ones with other discrete symmetries, this is a little bit different. You can think of H as being like the standard model Higgs. It's the only thing that gets a VEV, and all the new Higgses are in this field S. It's just a choice of basis in the HS field space. And forget about tan beta. There's no concept of tan beta here, because both of these Higgs doublets couple to all the quarks. So, it's almost obligatory when you read a paper advertising possible new CP violation to say that, this is exciting because it could be the origin of the baryon asymmetry. And yet, almost never do people really seriously try to connect those things. So that's my motivation here, being somebody who used to work a lot on electroweak baryogenesis. And electroweak baryogenesis is the only theory of baryogenesis I like, because I think it's the only one that can be tested in a way that will convince us if it's the right theory. So it's interesting to try to put these things together. And you probably know you need three ingredients for baryogenesis: new CP violation, and we see this model gives us lots of it. You need baryon violation, and that's already present in the standard model through anomalous processes. We call it Spallaron transitions that involve three leptons and nine left-handed quarks, so violate BNL by 3 units. These, even though you'll never see them in the laboratory, these are copious at the high temperatures near the electroweak phase transition. The difficult thing is getting out of thermal equilibrium. That's, as Sakharov told us many years ago, that's the other necessary ingredient. But in electroweak baryogenesis, the way this is achieved is by trying to make the electroweak phase transition first order. That is, if you look at the Higgs field as a function of temperature, this is increasing temperatures, a second order or crossover would be one where the field at high temperature, as you go from high temperature to low temperature, it just smoothly rolls down at some critical temperature. First order transition that we're interested in is the one where you develop this non-trivial vacuum, and you can have tunneling from the false vacuum to the true vacuum when the temperature gets below the critical one. Well, it's known that in the standard model, we don't get a strong first order phase transition. It's more like this, and in order to get this, you need new physics, new Higgs physics, new degrees of freedom coupling to the Higgs. And so we also have that in this model, and hopefully we can get a strong phase transition. How does electroweak baryogenesis work? Well, at the critical temperature, which is of order the weak scale, through this tunneling process, you get bubbles of the true vacuum forming inside of the false vacuum. True vacuum is where the Higgs got a BEV. False vacuum is electroweak symmetry is unbroken. And these bubbles are expanding, eventually going to fill up the universe. And as they're doing that, if you have CP violation going on in this bubble wall, quarks and leptons reflecting or interacting with that bubble wall will undergo partial transmission, partial reflection. Due to the CP violation, you can build up an asymmetry of chirality in front of the bubble wall. And that chirality drives the Spallaron interactions, which are fast outside the wall, to give a baryon asymmetry. Whereas the baryon asymmetry that gets inside the bubble is preserved because the Spallarons get shut off by this BEV. They're too heavy to be produced. And here's another picture filling in some of those details. Now I've portrayed the bubble as being very large, so the bubble wall just looks plainer. And here you see this buildup of a left-handed quark asymmetry due to the CP violating interactions of quarks with the bubble wall. And the Spallarons, they only like to eat left-handed quarks, so they try to erase that asymmetry, but every Spallaron interaction changes baryon number by 3, so this bias of the Spallarons leads to baryon asymmetry outside the wall, but the wall is moving this way, and so this baryon asymmetry will diffuse inside, and once it gets inside the bubble, it will be preserved if the phase transition is strong enough. What does that mean, strong enough? Well, it turns out numerically, it means that this Higgs BEV inside the bubble at the critical temperature has to be bigger than 1.0 times the just happens to be the critical temperature. So that's not just an order of magnitude, but that's actually a quantitative statement.
Okay, so the Spallarons are also responsible for matching lepton asymmetry and baryon asymmetry, because in the end you need charge neutrality of the universe. So I just wonder if the Spallarons are the ones which...
Well, yeah, so because of, I mean, you'll automatically have charge neutrality. You don't have to, because we're not breaking charge, right? So the Spallarons will, therefore, make a lepton asymmetry, which is of the same order as the baryon asymmetry, if this is all that's going on. Well, people have looked at electroweak baryogenesis in the two Higgs doublet model before, but they never looked at this particular model. They were always considering the usual forms of the model where some Z2 symmetry is imposed in order to prevent flavor-changing neutral currents, like one Higgs couples to the up type and one Higgs couples to the down type, like in the MSSM or other sorts of discrete symmetries. And as Mike has tried to convince you, minimal flavor violation is an interesting alternative to that. And so it's really a different model than what has been looked at in the past. And here's just a recap of the couplings of the quarks of the Higgs. Here we have the standard model-like couplings to the first Higgs H, and then these additional couplings to the second Higgs S, which has this MFV structure built into it. So, of course, another difference in our analysis is that we're going to try to explain the dimuon and B decay anomalies, which are inspiring this whole thing. And another difference is that we've really been very thorough in imposing all of these particle physics constraints, such as R sub B, which turns out to be quite stringent, electroweak precision data, LEP and tevatron mass limits, beta S gamma, EDM, also some theoretical consistency arguments. The vacuum has to be stable. You must not have runaway directions in the potential. And you don't want Landau poles spoiling the perturbativity of your theory. So we impose that they have to be bigger than TeV or so. I don't know what cut you put exactly. 2 TeV? Okay. And just for instance, these are the sorts of diagrams that you have to compute in order to impose the R sub B constraint. And so these put constraints on these new, we're called these new couplings, eta D, eta U, which are telling you the proportionality of the new Higgs coupling to the quarks relative to the usual Yukawa matrices. So these are putting constraints on eta D squared, and analogous diagrams with the charged new Higgses in the loop put constraints on eta U squared. And these constraints turn out to be quite stringent. And so we tried a few different ways of putting them together with the requirement of getting a strong electroweak phase transition. First, we tried making a grid in parameter space. Turns out that these are the most important couplings for the phase transition. And then there's, well, lambda 6 is not too important. We just set it to 1. Lambda 4 and 5, not too important. We set them to 0. So you have this, still it's a, and we just do a few Higgs masses, but there's a four-dimensional grid in parameter space. Search that, make a list of thousands and thousands of examples that pass the requirement of a strong first-order phase transition, and then hand it over to Mike, who checks to see how many of them survive the particle physics constraints, like electroweak precision and the dimuon anomaly in RB, and finds out none of them survive. So that doesn't work. So we go the other direction. We let Mike create the grid in parameter space, which already satisfies the phenomenological constraints. And then we check how many of those give a strong first-order phase transition. And that's not quite as bad. But it's a very small number that survives in the end, you know, something on order of 0.02%. And you see that the number goes down as the Higgs mass goes up. So already, one of our predictions is that if this is right, we expect that the Higgs mass is going to be low.
In principle, you would have thought that if you were the systematic, you would have actually at least gotten somewhere with number one. But it looks like it went very inefficient.
Yeah, I suppose if we used a finer grid, but well, there's another reason, and that is, and I'm coming to that actually. So, one of the parameters that I neglected here, which is lambda 5, let me just remind you, lambda 4 and lambda 5 are these ones that couple the new Higgs, or the two Higgses together. And so if you set those to 0, it's relatively easy to find a strong phase transition, but it's not so easy to satisfy the dimuon anomaly and R sub b together if you set lambda 5 to 0.
So there is an asymmetry, and I think that's the reason.
Central value of the signal, which is what we did, then it forces things to be light, and then you're really hitting bound from electric precision data and RV just because you have light scalars running around the loops, and those are very precise measurements.
Do you also impose that the quartics are perturbed?
Yes, so yeah, there's no Landau pole below 2 TeV. And I think that's something that other people have not done when they looked at this. Well, so even though these are small numbers, we can still do statistics with them. And this is showing you distributions of masses of the new neutral and charged scalars. And so, you know, it's relatively modest range in masses. Of course, this is just kind of indicative. It's not a strong prediction. And just to compare with so this is requiring a strong phase transition. If we only require the phenomenological constraints, then these distributions get broader, but they're not dramatically different. But for instance, the distribution of charged masses, you see it's much narrower when you require a strong phase transition. And so there is some impact on what you expect for the masses. Yes.
I've lost the argument here that there's only, ultimately you have one solution.
Yeah, I agree.
So all of those other ones you don't care about, you don't care whether that one solution is way on the tail, you don't care whether it likes the other solutions.
Yeah, but you see, I believe in the string theory landscape, and so to me, these are probability distributions, but yeah. If you don't believe in that, then this is just showing you the range of possibilities. And likewise, this is the prediction for the splitting of the two, the CP odd and CP even scalar masses, when you require a first order phase transition, and you see it's rather, if not broader, it's more filled in when you, don't require the phase transition. Yeah, so this is why I was saying we could have made much more pointed constraints if I could give this talk in just a few more days, because all of this is not yet requiring that we get a large enough baryon asymmetry. It's just one of the necessary requirements that there's a strong first order phase transition. And we'll narrow this down much more when we can finish the analysis. Now, how can we hope to see this at LHC? Well, one nice thing is that in all of these accepted points in parameter space, this parameter, which is telling you how strongly the S couples to B quarks, is rather large. Of course, it's really the product with the usual B-Yukawa coupling that counts, so it's not like a large coupling per se, but it's helping. And so one can expect that processes that produce the S and it decays into BB bar may be promising discovery channels at LHC. And Mark Wise and Mike Trott in their paper identified this process as being the the most promising. And it has some distinctive topology because these B events have a higher PT and lower rapidity than standard model 4B events. And so that will hopefully help you pick that out of the background. And they make this prediction for the production cross-section depending on the center of mass. And I've circled this region because this was sort of the peak of our probability distribution or our expectation for the mass of the new scalars. So, well, it's at least up there on the curve. And while I was writing this talk, it occurred to me that we can also
draw the same diagram with a charged, with a charged scalar production, which is giving us tops and bottoms, so two tops and two bottoms instead of four bottoms. And so to me, this seemed like this would also be an interesting channel, but I don't know. I'm not an expert in collider physics, so if you have some feedback about whether you think this is going to be suppressed or whether this is going to be just as good as the previous one, I'd be interested to hear from you. Well, that was the next thing. Is this what you were? I was also fantasizing about this one this morning, and my friends here tell me that the production for this is down by quite a bit relative to the pure QCD one. But so these would be four jets, and then pairs of jets would reconstruct through to these resonances. So I guess that would be pretty distinctive, but also just pretty rare. So maybe you only do this once you've discovered the other ones by the previous processes.
This is purely gluonic here.
On the right-hand diagram, presumably you mean a W boson there, given the charging components.
Which diagram?
The right-hand side.
It's BB bar, and then it has changes to a T. Yeah. It's BB bar at the vertex.
Yeah, BB bar. You're right.
Yeah.
So single talk. Yeah. Right. It's actually the dominant.
Well, this
system.
This is But then this will decay into, so it'll be two tops and two bottoms.
No, but the production diagram, you could have a W star or just gluon.
Well, this is what I was.
Yeah, I'm just wondering why you need that gluon in the middle. Why not a W, virtual W, giving UTB?
I just copied this diagram from that from this paper of Dawson and company. So I didn't really think about this, and I think Mike and Mark Weiss find that this is subdominant to this one. So if that's the case, then putting a W here will be even more so.
This process is good because you start with gluon PDFs, and also because you have collinear gluon splitting into the B4 pairs. So you get the collinear log enhancements from the gluon splitting with low PT, and you end up with two very distinct kinematics, two low PT B quarks, and then two high PT B quarks from the scalar resonance. You can pick those up at high PT, they'll be reconstructed into a rare one. So the PDFs help a lot for the gluon. So we think it's bigger than
that. The question of the W is if you're trying to produce the charged state.
Yeah.
What's the best way to look for that?
That's fine, yeah.
Okay, well, as I was saying, up to now, I was only concerned with this requirement of a strong phase transition, but still we need to do more. We need to get a big enough baryon asymmetry. And so we haven't had time to go through our list of 100 or 200 good possibilities to check whether they give enough baryons, but so I'll just present one example which works. So here's its mass spectrum, and so as I was saying, so you need to also make one of these parameters, lambda 4, lambda 5, non-zero, in order to get this to work. And the reason is that in order to have CP violating interactions of the top quark and the bubble wall, the top quark mass has to have a complex phase which is varying in the wall. And that complex phase is coming from here. The S field is complex, and this coupling A to U is complex. So some linear combination of these things has to be present. And so either S could be real and A to U could be complex, or et cetera. But in order to get S to be there at all, you need one of these couplings which mixes H and S to not vanish. You see, we've chosen our field basis so that
S doesn't get a BEV at all at zero temperature. Once you go to high temperature, then it can start getting a small BEV inside the bubble wall. And here I'm showing the picture. So this is what the potential looks like in the vicinity of the true the false vacuum and the true vacuum that's emerging at the critical temperature. And here you see the barrier and the path, so the least action path in field space. And so you see it's making this excursion, a small excursion, to non-zero S, which is what we need to get that complex phase of the top mass. And since this complex phase is multiplied by the ADU parameter, we want that to be as big as possible. But it turns out that that's strongly constrained by R sub B. So we, in order to get this to work, we assume that the one sigma limit on that is saturated. And when you do all this, you find that you can just barely get a large enough baryon asymmetry. It's not like we have orders of magnitude of freedom and we're just going to tune to get the observed one. No, it seems like in this model, we never get anything that's much bigger than it's observed, and if we work hard enough, we get something which is about right. So it looks like the model is going to be extremely predictive. Oh, Z is my coordinates going through here's the bubble wall, so it's just the coordinate transverse to that. And so why is it so difficult to make all of this work? Because you would think, okay, by increasing lambda 4 or lambda 5, I can crank up this excursion into the into non-zero S and make it as big as I want. And also, you would think that non-zero lambda 5 is good because, as I was saying, we need it for this is the expression for the Wilson coefficient that explains the di muon anomaly that Mike showed us. Now it's with the effect of lambda 5 in it, and so by having non-zero lambda 5, you can make this coefficient eta prime d smaller, and that's good for R sub b. R sub b wants that to be small. Okay, so there's two reasons why you think large lambda 5 should help, but then when you try it, you find that lambda 5 tends to kill the bump that's in the potential and make it a second-order transition. And you can easily see that just by taking this tree-level expression, or you know, the tree potential, and integrating out S. And that gives you this negative contribution to the potential, which has the shape of an anti-bump. So essentially, it's just canceling the bump that I had for the first-order transition, which typically it's a very delicate thing. It's easy to destroy that bump. And the other thing that's making this hard is that this coefficient A to U, which is also entering into the imaginary part of the top quark, that just has to be small due to these EDM and R sub B constraints. So, this is just one of our technical challenges. To try and get a reliable number, in order to get that number for the baryon asymmetry, you have to solve the Boltzmann equations for the chemical potentials of the particle species that you're trying to keep track of, like those left-handed quarks. But the left-handed quarks, they interact with Higgs, so that produces a Higgs asymmetry and a right-handed quark asymmetry, B quark. But those interact with W's, and so eventually this asymmetry, which just started out as left-handed top quarks, gets dispersed into a lot of different species. And some of those species can diffuse much farther than quarks can, like Higgs. So it's important to keep track of that. And yet, you know, you don't want to have to keep track of all 20 or 30 species. So people typically just try to reduce it to the species they think are relevant, such as left and right tops, left bottom, and Higgs. And then you've just got 8 equations to solve, and it's a boundary value problem that you can numerically solve, and so you get these sorts of profiles for the various chemical potentials. And then you can use that to figure out the, how much baryon asymmetry the Snellerons make. But as we investigate this, we find it seems to be rather sensitive to how many of these fields you keep in the game. And so we need to do more work to figure out, you know, when does this really start to converge. So it's just kind of a tedious problem. Well, in summary, I think that this model, minimal flavor violating two Higgs doublet model, I think it's a nice model to look at. In some ways, it seems more natural than the other two Higgs doublet models that have a kind of ad hoc Z2 symmetry. And well, if these anomalies hold up, then obviously it will be more interesting. And we see that we can get baryogenesis out of this model, and it will be very constrained, I think, when we do the full analysis. Already, we see the strong phase transition constrains us a lot. The thing that's a little disappointing is my opening question was, you know, new CP phase, how is that related to baryogenesis? Well, unfortunately, that new phase that gives us the dimuon anomaly is not the one that's giving us baryogenesis. It's coming from some of these other CP phases that are in the model. But and, well, maybe another place where this will show up is we see that this quark coupling parameter has to be as big as possible for us to get a big enough baryon asymmetry. And so maybe we'll expect to see some tension in R sub D as future data improves. And so our predictions are that we should see some rather light states, and hopefully one could discover them through these four jet events at LHC. So thank you very much.